Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Sherry McCracken and I represent Vernon Harris. Are you hearing me all right?
Yes.
My ears are plugged, so I don't hear myself very well. We are here because attorney's fees and costs were wrongly granted to the state. Federal and state law and policy, as well as congressional intent, generally prohibits an award of attorney's fees and costs to the prevailing defendant in a civil rights case under Christenberg. Christenberg says that defendants are to be granted fees only when claims are frivolous, groundless, or vexatious.
The district court here found that a number of the claims were frivolous.
Actually, I think that's a mixed message, Your Honor. In a 56-page order on the granting the motions for summary judgment in this matter, the district court found nothing frivolous, vexatious, or groundless. It was only
That was on a motion for summary judgment, and frivolous is not a standard of review for granting summary judgment.
That's true.
Well, when it came to attorney's fees, that's when he had to determine whether the claims were frivolous, and he determined that a number of them were frivolous.
And another number of them were not. Yes. And that being true, under Christenberg, Christenberg sets a very high standard for frivolous in awarding fees to defendants. In fact, Hughes, the Supreme Court, said that awarding fees in a pro per case where the prisoner did not even survive a motion for summary judgment did not rise to the level of frivolous under Christenberg. Further, in this case, Mr. Harris survived two motions for summary judgment. The first motion for summary judgment was filed 3 years into this litigation, and I refer this court to, I believe it's Christian versus Mattel, where this court in remanding suggested any case that took 700 hours of attorney time might not be frivolous. In this case, we're talking about the defense spending well over 2,000 hours in this matter. There are other reasons that attorney's fees should not be granted in this case besides Christenberg. First, fees are not available in Arizona when contractual type claims arise out of statute. And here you'll recall that Mr. Harris argued that his claims to due process and property arose out of the Arizona rules of the Supreme Court, which the district court said were only guidance as the realtor's code. They arose out of the Employment Protection Act, and they arose out of the policies and regulations of the Maricopa County Superior Court, particularly the Sexual Harassment Act. This court also previously denied a motion for fees and sanctions on the same exact grounds, on the same exact arguments. If the appeal wasn't groundless and frivolous, it seems hard to believe that the underlying claims were frivolous. The district court here indulged in the temptation to find frivolous claims after the fact, after finding nothing frivolous in its summary judgment motion. The fees sought here are not reasonable, properly supported, nor rationally related. The fee application submission does not comply with Kerr or Arizona law. The chilling effect to plaintiffs and their attorneys here will be profound. 89 to 100% of the fees awarded on each claim were identified by the state solely as general fees, fees the state could not attribute to any claim, and then they were divided by 10 and ascribed to the claims where fees were awarded. The district court here identified claims as contract to award fees, but related to the civil rights claims to award costs, maximizing the award. The state refused to discuss settlement in this matter. Early on, it could have been settled for my client being rehired and having the state, Maricopa County, go through its own policies and procedures. As I said before, an award of fees here is against the standards in Christianburg, and Christianburg is the standard, followed by Hughes.
Let me go back to what you said earlier about the contract claims.
Yes.
What did you say about Arizona law?
Arizona law says that something has to arise out of contract, and that those claims, contract type, a public employee would have, arise out of statute, policies, regulations. Those kinds of claims don't arise out of contract.
Yes.
For purposes of ARS 12-341, under which the district court awarded fees.
Well, I thought the district court awarded fees under 1988.
It did.
Rather than, yeah.
Well, it awarded under both.
But the question is whether 1988 allows you to award fees for state claims. And I think the district court adopted the Seventh Circuit view that under 1988 you can award fees for state claims, rather than looking to the state statute as to whether fees would be awarded under the state statute. Is that not right?
It may very well be, Your Honor. But again, if you're awarding fees in the federal sector, you have to comply with the Christianburg standard and the Kerr factors.
I understand that.
And they didn't even comply with the Kerr factors. Also, under Arizona law, if you're working with Arizona law, associate indemnity makes clear that chilling awards must be viewed with particular consideration.
Well, the judge cut the fees by 50%.
Yes.
Because of the financial circumstances.
Your Honor, I think that's a difference without a difference. Whether my client, who earns $52,000 a year, has sole legal custody of his three children, can pay $125,000,
analyzed. Are those two different issues, whether the financial circumstances and whether there's a chilling, or are they a single issue?
I actually think that they're separate issues. I think a chilling effect of $125,000 in total, more, is chilling to all of the plaintiff's bar and any plaintiff who'd make a claim. Congress, in passing Title VII and giving an incentive for Title VII plaintiffs' attorneys' fees, recognized that simply filing a claim and getting an attorney to represent you took an incentive. We've provided affidavits talking about the chilling effect, and we also provided information that most of your
Title VII claims the district court found were not frivolous, so there were no fees awarded for the Title VII claims.
Except there was a fee awarded, I believe, for the hostile work environment,
but on that one you were just plainly outside the statute of limitations.
I thought I had a decent argument, Your Honor. But even if I was plainly outside the statute of limitations, Christianburg makes clear that those claims that were the same core of facts that are the other civil rights claims does not incur attorney's fees under Title VII. That sometimes you're going to be amiss, sometimes you're going to lose, but you don't get punished for losing. This court can take judicial notice of pleadings that have been before the Ninth Circuit. EEOC versus Maricopa County, number 05-15403. Last March, this court refused to grant fees against the EEOC. There is another one coming up for argument in another month, Parentau versus Prescott Unified School District. Back to the Kerr factors, which I think that even if the state is found to, quote, deserve fees, they didn't submit an adequate fee application. The court never decided what the prevailing rate in the relevant community was for the defendant. The plaintiff pointed out that this has not been proven and provided several cases that contradicted and affidavits, information, public requests that contradicted what Ms. Baker said was her reasonable rate in the relevant community. The state didn't specify in its fee application what items went to what claims. 80% of the fee application were ascribed to general fees. If they're general fees, I would believe that that meant they had to be done for everything, even the good civil rights claims, and thus they shouldn't have ascribed 10% of them or $25,000.
What obligation did the county have? How could I identify? I mean, there's some things that just have to be done in litigation, irrespective of the number of claims. How should the district court have apportioned those?
Your Honor, I believe that the case law in this circuit, Camacho, Crouch, and Fuddruckers, says that all doubt must be resolved in favor of the plaintiff in these matters, and that lawyers who are experienced need to keep their fees in such a way that a court can decide what's reasonably to charge. What I think's not reasonable is to have one claim where defendants identified something like $69 worth of time to the claim, and they were awarded over $25,000 because of the general fees. Also, even in the things that were ascribed, defendants divided individual fee lines by 3, 4, and 5. It is not the district court's job, nor even mine, to decide what these itemized items meant. We are supposed to be able to reasonably judge. Then, as to costs, if you will look at ER 242 A and B, there was no reasonable and accurate rendition of costs. The invoices upon which this schedule relies, and the schedule seems to be the only thing the district court relies on, the invoices all say for services rendered. That doesn't tell this court whether that was reasonable or necessary. And some of those fees were for investigating Mr. Harris's psychologist for ethics violations by a hired expert.
Do you want to save your last 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I certainly do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Catherine Baker, and I represent the state of Arizona in this case. This case is quite important on behalf of defendants, particularly municipal defendants who frequently are placed in the position of defending against frivolous claims brought by plaintiff's counsel who think there is no downside to doing so.
Frivolous and non-frivolous claims combined in one suit.
Exactly. But here, Your Honor, the frivolous claims predominated. In fact, there were...
Not my calculation.
Okay.
It was basically a civil rights case. And the basic civil rights claims were found to be non-frivolous, except some, like the ones where the statute had run hostile work environment. But that also involves basic race discrimination claim. Why do you say it predominates? I mean, aren't they related to the basic claim, which was found to be non-frivolous?
I have to respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The reason
that
I said the frivolous and meritless claims predominate in this case is because the district court exercised its reasonable discretion and found 10 separate claims, distinct claims, separately pled, separately brought, separately argued, separately briefed, subject to different tests.
Now, when you say separately briefed, do you mean
yes.
There's a brief and you say there was race discrimination and part of it was hostile environment, part of it's, you know, one claim. They're stated under different theories, but it's the same basic claim.
Well, and again, I disagree, Your Honor. I think they are distinct, as set forth in the Tudor-Saliba case, where they say when you look at the claims, are they distinct? Are they brought on separate grounds? Are they briefed separately? Are they subject to separate tests?
Separate theories, right?
Yeah, they are separate theories.
I'm fired, and I say it's a violation of the civil rights statute, and it's a breach of contract.
Well, but you say more specifically it's a disparate impact claim. It is a hostile work environment based on gender. It's a hostile work environment based on race, two very different things, which were found frivolous in this case for two very different reasons. And you also say it's a deprivation of my property interest. Separate test applicable to that.
Discharge, and you say it's not only a civil rights violation to discharge me, it violates contract. There are four contract claims.
There were three, Your Honor.
Well, I thought there were four, including the due process, isn't it?
Well, the due process, as far as the district court found in the exercise of its discretion and agreed to by counsel in front of the district court, is there were three. There was the express breach of contract claim. There was a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And then there was the due process property interest claim. Those are the three claims that were found to be contract claims.
The same thing. You fired me, and it's a breach of contract. It's a breach of due process to fire me. I have a liberty interest, I've got this interest, all resulting from my firing. I mean, you know, there are two theories of life. You know, one is you give a judge 10 arguments for your to win a case. This was one of my first cases. And one, you just give them the best one. And sometimes you find the judges aren't as bright as you'd like, and he picks one of your weaker arguments. So, you know what's happened to you, and you give them a lot of theories on which to decide it. But it's, I don't want to make you a speech, but let's get to the last argument, basically. If you have to defend against these claims, and you spend a lot of time on it, and you can't allocate it among the various claims, and you say, well, here's $250,000 I spent, and I can't tell you on which claim. Some of those claims are meritorious or non-frivolous. Some are frivolous. Doesn't that suggest that all of that may have been spent on the non-frivolous ones, and you can't tell how much was spent on the frivolous ones?
Again, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. And the reason for that is there's a difference between claims that arise from the same core of operative facts, i.e., I got fired, I've got 10 claims, and claims that are distinct and alleged separately. In other words, I got fired, I think it's race discrimination.
Then once you say, okay, I spent $250,000,
sure.
I don't know what they're spent on.
Well, no one said I don't know what they're spent on. What we did was
Why did you divide it by 10?
Because in the realities of litigation, for example, there were roughly 15 to 17 depositions in this case, primarily taken by the plaintiff. In those depositions, they went through all 10 of their separate theories, trying to establish each of the elements for those separate theories. As defense counsel, when I bill my time, it's not possible, it's not practical, it's not even reasonable for a court to expect me to delineate in my time entries the specific amount of time spent on each and every of the 10 separate claims. And the courts recognize that in order to allocate general fees to separate claims, it's acceptable to use a percentage. And here what the court did is divided the 10 claims.
Where do the courts recognize that? What case is that?
Okay, we have the, the Carnes case we cited, which involved a Lanham Act claim, where they used both sides had the issue of, and that was quite a large fee claim, as you recall, both sides had the problem of the general fees, because in practical litigation, this is what happens. Each suggested a percentage allocation. The court used a percentage allocation as being reasonable. Also, in the Tudor-Saliba,
both parties agreed to that method.
Well, both suggested a percentage, didn't agree with how the court did it.
But there the court accepted what the party said, that it was a reasonable method in that case.
There's also the Tudor Saliba case where a 20% allocation was used, and what the court did was remanded it to the district court saying that the basis for the allocation wasn't specifically enough explained, but it didn't object to the 20% allocation. There's really, practically speaking, Your Honor, no other way to do it. Plaintiffs, when they seek fees, have the same problems as defendants do, and that is there's no practical way in practice, especially when you have a plaintiff who has 10 separate claims, all with different elements, to go through and bill and put, for example, when you're in an 8-hour deposition, what relates specifically to each claim. How much time, for example? That's true, and the courts have recognized, for example, when you interview witnesses, when you talk on the phone, when you talk to your client. All of those things are applicable to the case as a whole, and there is no practical way to separate it out. And if I might, Your Honor, in looking at the plaintiff's complaint that, oh my gosh, there were $589.67 allocated to one claim, but when you put the 10% of the total general fees in, you have roughly $28,000 in fees. The reverse was also true, where we were denied $40,433 in fees when only $15,000 were directly applicable to the claims, where we only had $441.46 in a bill applicable to a claim on which we didn't get fees, and we were denied $30,000 in fees. It works both ways because that's the practical reality of the situation. There isn't a way to do a fee claim without a percent allocation like this when you have 10 separate claims, 15 to 17 depositions, when you have this many issues being raised by the plaintiff.
Okay.
Your Honor,
It is your burden, isn't it, on attorney's fees?
Absolutely, and we met that burden, Your Honor, with a detailed fee application.
I
agree.
I just want to make sure we were in agreement on the stand.
No, we are in agreement, Your Honor, and we did provide affidavits. For example, counsel says that we didn't provide information on the prevailing rate, but if you look at the court's...
I don't think that's...
Right, okay. All right. You asked a question earlier of counsel about the contract claims, and what the court actually did for those three contract claims was did award them pursuant to the Arizona statute 12-341-01 and went through the associated indemnity factors for those three contract-based claims and did award fees on that basis, even though the claims were also found to be meritless and without foundation and therefore would be consistent with a fee award under the Christianberg standard. The fees were awarded under the state statute. The state statute does allow that. What counsel's comments about fees not being allowed under contract if a statute is involved is in error. And what we'd ask...
Didn't the district court say that all the state claims could be, that fees could be awarded under Section 1988?
What the court did is first analyze the three contract claims under ARS Section 341-01 and found that fees were awardable under that statute for those three claims. Then it went to the federal claims and found which were frivolous and which were non-frivolous, and it awarded fees on the non-frivolous on the frivolous claims, even though they were mixed with non-frivolous claims, based on the Tudor Saliba case that allows that to occur. Well, what I'm getting to is then what it did is it went to the pendant state law claims, and that's where it used the Seventh Circuit case of Munson. And for the pendant state law claims for which fees had not already been awarded, the three claims, two of which were pendant state law claims under the contract theory, ARS 12-341-01, the court then awarded fees on the frivolous pendant state law claims under the Munson case, which cited a Ninth Circuit case, saying that it only makes sense.
Okay. I was trying to get the answer. The district court said that the state court claims fees could be awarded under 1988.
Yes, pursuant to the Munson case. And, Your Honor, on behalf of the defendants who daily have to litigate cases like this, we think that the court paid very great attention to the tests that were applicable to the various different claims and to the standards that it needed to evaluate in order to exercise its reasonable discretion. Counsel did raise an issue about law of the case, but that's not applicable because this court's prior order simply said fees will not be awarded, did not give grounds for it, which left the district court to exercise its reasonable discretion, and it took great pains to do so here.
Well, when we denied fees, it's on the question of whether an appeal is frivolous. I don't think that that has, well, maybe it does, I don't know. All we decided, if anything, was that the appeal was not frivolous.
Nothing was decided with regard to fees on whether the appeal was frivolous or non-frivolous because the order simply says fees are denied. And under the Thompson case from this court, if all that is said is fees are denied, it's certainly possible that the court found the appeal frivolous but nonetheless exercised its discretion not to award fees. So it's basically a non-issue, I guess is what I'm saying, which left the discretion to the district court in order to award these fees. And what it did, as you know, is when it got to, when it finally got down to the lodestar, which was significantly less than what we asked for, it cut it in half based on the plaintiff's financial condition, bringing the fee award down to $85,500. Then we get to the costs, and I want to bring the court's attention to a footnote that we did include in our brief, and counsel alluded to the fact that there were some costs awarded and then not subtracted for the non-frivolous federal claims, and we dropped a footnote and said in the cost there was a calculation of roughly $18,000 that could be reduced from the cost award to make it accurate. But under a situation like this, and on behalf of the state of Arizona, it's absolutely imperative that this court adopt a standard where defendants have parity in their ability to offset the cost of frivolous litigation. And you can see what happened here, and that was the plaintiff had no incentive to fully evaluate the claims, make sure they were non-frivolous, do the research before the claims were stated, get rid of the case along the way when it became clear that the case was groundless. The state offered a walkaway. There was no interest in that. A walkaway, of course, is a waiver of a claim for costs and fees. And plaintiffs who know there is no downside have no reason not to just throw in a civil rights claim, say, hey, that's going to save me on all the rest of my claims, and put the state of Arizona through what it was put through in this case, which was, oh, as we know, in a gross amount, over $300,000 in attorney's fees. And so on behalf of the state of Arizona and the other defense litigants, and I have to say to the court that I do plaintiffs' cases as well, and I understand it's very important to evaluate the validity of claims before they're brought because you know that fees could be awarded, but good, competent plaintiffs' counsel, I do not believe would be chilled in any way by the order in this case because the court exercised its discretion to make it so clear.
I'm sure not all plaintiffs' counsel are as competent as you are, particularly those who represent civil rights litigants.
But well, Your
I'm
Honor,
trying to pay you a compliment because your time's up.
Okay. And, Your Honor, I'm sure many are more competent than me. I was just trying to make the point that I don't think it will chill. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
No downside? My firm lost 2 years of profits. No downside? My client is broke. No downside? I sued City Hall. But also, contradictory, counsel just told you that there were 10 discrete claims that were briefed separately. If you briefed them separately, you could identify 80% of general claims. I ask this court not to overturn Christianberg. The state of Arizona is basically asking for Christianberg to be overturned to further chill what is a daunting task, taking on the state which has endless resources, which never settles anything, particularly in a case where no one ever discussed settlement, and when you go through defendant's billings, she never talked to the real client in interest. She talked to risk management. not the Arizona Supreme Court, not the new presiding judge of the Maricopa County Superior Court. And there was not an offer to walk away. What it was a letter that said, I think my client might undertake to consider a walkaway offer. My client, from a year before counsel started in this matter, tried to get a discussion going, a settlement discussion going, and this wasn't a frivolous case. This was a case where Maricopa County Superior Court investigated my client, a black male. He was the fourth person we know of to have been investigated for sexual harassment. All of those men were black. A year later, we suddenly, after this litigation, we have white men. But we have a tremendous difference that unfortunately the Ninth Circuit and the district court didn't find. The investigative file on my client was some 600 pages with documents thrown in, according to counsel's own testimony and deposition comment. And the white men all had these wonderful files. The presiding judge took no evidence. He wanted only things in writing. And furthermore, the state, in refusing to talk to us, did not tell us until after this litigation was filed that the reason my client was fired was not sexual harassment. This is not a case for fees. The other thing I want to say is remember that those depositions had to all be retaken because in the middle of this case, the state changed its theory and suddenly had a defense on advice of counsel. Also, the state claimed everyone, and we have a bad ethics rule in Arizona, but claimed that everyone was their client, so we couldn't speak to anyone. I ask this court to not only not overturn Christenberg, but I think that maybe you should look at Carver v. Lehman and send a message that summary judgment doesn't mean that the plaintiff has to prove their case on paper. Thank you.
Case just argued will be submitted.